We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
It's 6 minutes after 1 o'clock, and this is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. We bring you an archived version of the Afternoon Magazine's 1 o'clock interview at this time. Since it is a tape program, no phone calls, please.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. In 1988, sugar conglomerate Tate & Lyle bought Decatur corn processor A.E. Staley. The relationship between the new owners and workers quickly became strained, and in 1993, in June of that year, Staley locked them out. The lockout lasted more than 900 days. At the time of the lockout, Staley employed 762 workers. At the end of the lockout in December of 1995, there would be less than half that many jobs. Today, we'll look back at the lockout and its impact on workers and the community, as well as the lessons it offers for labor today. Our guests are Stephen Ashby and C.J. Hawking. They are the authors of a book about Staley and labor. The title, Staley, The Fight for a New American Labor Movement. Hawking and Ashby say the Staley workers did not simply fight Tate and Lyle's lockout. They also sought to build a new American labor movement. Stephen Ashby is a clinical associate professor in the Chicago Labor Education Program in the School of Labor Relations at the University of Illinois. C.J. Hawking is a United Methodist pastor and the executive director of the faith-based workers' rights group, Arise Chicago. The two, who are husband and wife, were Staley workers' organizers. They say up front they claim no impartiality. Staley, The Fight for a New American Labor Movement is a volume in the series The Working Class in American History from the University of Illinois Press. Stephen Ashby, C.J. Hawking, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste.
My pleasure.
How did the two of you become involved as organizers for Staley workers?
Well, I'll speak first. I've been a labor activist much of my life. I've been a union member, and I just finished a PhD in American labor history at the University of Chicago. When I met the workers at a forum, and they talked about their in-plant campaign, and there were scores of people there, and the workers and unions, they were just so inspired, this local that had gone from this apathetic, uninvolved, hardly anybody shows up at union meetings, which unfortunately describes too many local unions, into this dynamic organization. They began with 850 people, but they'd have 1,000 people every week at union meetings, family members, other unionists. And so I was very inspired by them. And when they were locked out after they launched this 10-month in-plant campaign, they were thrown out of the plant, and scabs were brought in by this multinational corporation. Then we formed a solidarity group to support them in Chicago, and it was a huge part of my life for the next 2.5 years.
And C.J. Hawking?
Well, my story is not quite as heroic, at least in the beginning. I have been involved in social justice ministry in the 25 years that I've been involved in ministry. And on a Thursday night in July of 1993, I had my first blind date with Stephen. And the formation of the Staley Workers Solidarity Committee in Chicago was going to be taking place 2 days later on a Saturday. And I primarily went to check this guy out. I had always been pro-labor, but other than being taught not to cross a picket line, I didn't fully understand the impact of labor. So I went to this meeting, and I was just completely swept away by the three Staley workers who spoke at that. As a pastor, I had been seeing the lines for the soup kitchens and the homeless shelters doubling and tripling. And as I sat there in that meeting in July of 1993, I thought, well, this is the source of the problem. We need greater and stronger unions so that we no longer have a term working poor, and so that workers are treated fairly and that the middle class stays intact.
Who spoke at that meeting in July of 93, and what did they say?
There were three workers, Dan Lane, Wayne Carlisle, and Ron Van Syck, who were later to become close friends. And they talked about how they were under attack from this multinational corporation. The Staley Company had been around Decatur for decades, and yeah, there were a few labor management problems, but for the most part, it was a fairly amiable relationship. And when the Staley family was taken out of the equation and a multinational conglomerate took over the plant, all hell broke loose as far as workers' rights. And I could see at that time, as many of us do, that having a company run by a group of people who don't even live in the community feels very different than having a company run by folks who you've known your whole life and who might be your neighbors or you run into in the library. It's just a very different feel to it, and a significant change within our society, one, I think, to our detriment.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, you and CJ open this story in Staley, the Fight for a New American Labor Movement, in May of 1990 with the death of Jim Beals, a 43-year-old worker at the plant, and he had worked at Staley for 27 years. What would you like to tell us about him?
Yes, his death really galvanized the workers. It wasn't a fight, which went on for 3.5-4 years, over wages, really, although they did want to cut the wages a bit. They made roughly, $11 an hour. But it was about working conditions and treatment and demanding respect and dignity and about safety. So the company came in, and actually the workers had a lot of hope that things might improve. Things had begun to deteriorate under a previous owner who had bought the company from the Staley family. And instead, this company basically came in and said, we're going to maximize profit. We're changing work rules. We don't care about safety anymore. We want speed up. And so Jim was one of many workers who began to organize and resist this. And he filed a grievance that morning saying, look, this tank that you're asking us to go clean, you're not cutting it off. Someone's going to get injured. You're breaking all the procedures. You're violating the law of Occupational Safety and Health Act. And they said, well, we'll talk about it later, but do the job now. And he went in and he did the job. Poisonous fumes, chemical fumes came into the tank. One worker barely got out, and Jim couldn't, it sucks the oxygen out of the air. He immediately, within seconds, was dead. So for the workers, it's like he was a prophet. If we don't improve safety, people are going to die, and that very day he dies. Mm. So that began the resistance.
Yeah. The number of complaints like the one Jim Beals made on the day he died, they were on the increase, and the company had reduced the number of workers on its safety team from 24 to 3. So would one of you give us some idea of what that meant inside the plant and what the workers' concerns were prior to Jim Beals' death?
CJ, do you want to take that one or you want me to?
You go ahead.
Well, as CJ said, under the old Staley family, they formed a union in the 40s. Things weren't perfect there, but they really felt like they could solve problems together. There weren't huge numbers of grievances filed. It was a fairly amicable relationship. When the company was sold to Continental and then to Tate and Lyle, and things began to deteriorate, the workers really felt like they were putting their lives in danger every day when they went to the plant. I worked in a plant just like this one, much smaller, called American Maize in Northwest Indiana for a number of years in the 80s. And they make high fructose corn syrup, that's what we made as well, which is in almost everything today. It's a sugar substitute, you know, peanut butter and bread and soda pop and beer and endless numbers of foods. And the plant is very hot in areas, and it's really a chemical process. And the workers at Staley would say, this is a chemical plant. You know, we don't make chemicals. We make high fructose corn syrup, which is a food product, but it's really a chemical plant, and it's very dangerous. Explosions can happen. People can breathe in fumes and die, breathe in dangerous dust and get cancer if you don't have protections, if you don't put the workers' interests as a priority, protecting their safety. And the company, Tate & Lyle, basically said, we don't care. Maximize profit, turn out product, cut costs. In many ways, what we saw back in the 90s and the workers' resistance is what's happening today. We see with Wall Street basically destroying the economy of this country and the world, kind of corporate greed run amok, and a beginning of a resistance today. And the Staley workers were basically taking a stand and saying, this is corporate greed run amok. This is a corporation that doesn't care about its people or people in the community, and we're going to lead a resistance. So they really paved the way, and even though they lost ultimately, and even though it happened 10 years ago, it's very much about the conditions in America today and what kind of country we want to live in and how people can come together in broad coalitions to put people's interests first.
Yeah. It is now more than 10 years later. Why did the two of you decide to write this book?
During the 2.5 years that we were involved with the struggle, we saved every piece of paper, every flyer, every handwritten note. And so when the struggle ended in December of 95, we had 7 file cabinets filled with the papers and all this information about what happened during the struggle. Plus, we lived it. I think for as much as one could be a locked out as close to the locked out workers as possible, we were. And it took a while after the defeat to kind of recover from it, quite honestly. It really felt like a knife in the heart to many of us because they were very close to winning. And so after a few years passed and we got married and we had a baby and we moved and everything, then it came time to write the book. And I think it was just a compelling act that we needed to do in order to get these workers' stories out there, in order to inform the labor movement today of all the heroic things that the Staley workers did and the history of it, but also to share with workers today the insights and the incredible strategies that the Staley workers used that can be very effective today.
Okay, so this story has significance for labor today.
Yes.
Yeah. This is the afternoon.
This is one of the most important labor struggles of the last 25 years, but if nobody writes about it, it gets forgotten. You know, until the 60s and 70s, when all the social movements arose and the historians started to write a different kind of history. Before that, it was pretty much top-down history. And even the history of organizations like unions was, what did the leaders do? And then historians started to write what's called social history, kind of a bottom-up history. What did the people do? And they kind of found this history of blacks and African Americans and women and gays and lesbians and workers and wrote books about it and wrote articles so that it can be taught so the history is remembered and not forgotten. And so that was really very much on our minds as well. Just if we don't write this, it'll be forgotten. Everything they did, the power of their stories. And we really tried to tell the story through the workers' voices, almost like a novel. I mean, that's our goal, to make it really accessible to people and an interesting read.
Our guests this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, Stephen Ashby and C.J. Hawking. They are the authors of Staley, The Fight for a New American Labor Movement. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now from a listener in Effingham on line 4. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call, Celeste. I would like to relate to your guests that here in Effingham, which is highly conservative, you know, the further south you go out of Chicago and Champaign, Decatur areas, that it becomes more conservative. Here in Effingham, was it 900 days, the Staley workers? I should remember that because I went to some protests there. I think I know in support of some of the Firestone and Caterpillar people. But nevertheless, the 900 days would be near 3 years, I think.
Mm-hmm. It was 908 days.
Okay. Well, here in Effingham, as I'm speaking and as you are listening, there are 35 women who opted to form a union with ATSME, and now it is 24 months that they have been locked out, and nobody pays attention. There is nothing happening. Management has isolated the workers. They are allowed one little building in front of the site where it's a Heartland Human Services. It's a state and I think taxpayer-funded institution to help the mentally ill and to give them some sort of treatment. And now they took scabs in. I think it was almost within weeks after the ladies opted to strike. They then went back to management, and evidently the union can do nothing, and asked for their jobs back. We'll go ahead and negotiate, but let us come back to work, and they locked them out. Escorted the head of the organization into the institution with police, which is an old tactic.
Mm-hmm.
No, they were no more fearsome to anyone than they were to their children. And here they're treated in that manner in this tiny little town, and now 24 months have gone by and almost nothing. I'm wondering if there is no labor management rules that exist that would go to arbitration by a federal mediator and have redress to this issue. I mean, these ladies, you know, have suffered all this time, and it seems open-ended. And do you know of any? They have tried everything, internet and the whole nine yards, and are still just isolated. Would you have any?
Well, I'm very sympathetic. I've met some of the workers. They're very inspiring, just ordinary people like the Staley workers who say, you know, we just want justice and we're not going to settle for anything less. We teach an online program. I coordinate an online program at University of Illinois, and we have about 2,000 students a semester in labor studies. And we do a practice quiz with them and talking about the conditions workers face and labor law and employment law. And they get almost all the questions wrong over and over again. American people just have no idea how bad labor law, laws protecting workers' right to organize and strike, and employment law benefits and so forth are in this country. We have the worst labor and employment law in any industrialized country in the world by far. You know, we were so proud of saying we're number one and we're the best. Well, we're the worst in how we treat workers. These workers are locked out in Effingham. It should be illegal. It's a moral outrage. The company refuses to negotiate seriously with them. Scab should be illegal, that you work years for a job and you're permanently replaced. The company, you know, it's an outrage how workers are treated in this country. And we really need, part of our book is try to revitalize the labor movement. You know, to be quite honest, part of labor and its leadership got kind of apathetic, complacent and unwilling to fight as the attacks came down. And we need a new labor movement that's very bottom-up, the type of women at Effingham and the workers at Staley who say, we want to reach out, we want to build support, we want to fight for workers' rights, join us.
Hmm. C.J. Hawking, earlier you said that the Staley workers, They came close to winning. How close did they get, and why did ultimately they not get there?
The Staley workers did a lot of traveling across the country and developed a program called Road Warriors, where the workers themselves went out to union halls and spoke about their story, and it resonated with the listeners. And it really served to reinvigorate the labor unions that they were visiting. And so this kept building and building, and eventually they had 30 solidarity committees across the country. Kind of blows your mind to think that this tiny little local union in Decatur, Illinois, had people in San Francisco, New York, Seattle, Kansas City, L.A., just everywhere across the country supporting them. And their sole purpose in coming together was to advocate for these workers in Decatur, Illinois. So at the beginning of the lockout, the Staley workers engaged in what's called a corporate campaign, where you try and target a company so that it experiences economic losses and therefore has an impact on your own company. And at first they tried State Farm, and unfortunately that was not very successful. And then they moved on to Miller Beer, which was a prime customer of the Staley high fructose corn syrup. And after about 7 or 8 months, Miller Beer decided that it would no longer buy its ingredients from the Staley Corporation. They were going to go elsewhere. And that was because across the country, so many people put pressure on them to stop buying products from this company. After the Miller success, and also Leinenkugel beer out of Wisconsin decided to go to another supplier, the Staley workers turned their attention to Pepsi. And we were having some great success across the country, going to events and concerts and neighborhood festivals where Pepsi was the sponsor, and advocating that they, too, stop buying the Staley product. We had word from fairly reliable sources that Pepsi, in late 1995, was indeed going to dump Staley and find another supplier. The contract was up December 31st, 1995. And as it got closer and closer to this date, we were flooding Pepsi with calls. They had an 800 number at the time. They had to hire new workers just to answer the phone. And it looked extremely hopeful. But unfortunately, that was not to be, that the fight ended December 22nd of 1993. And so it was really the Pepsi campaign that we thought could really bring about a victory. If Pepsi collapsed, Coke was the next target, and surely Coke was going to collapse too. And if after losing all those customers, it was widely believed that the Staley Company would then offer the workers a fair contract.
Mm. Let's take
part of what happened there is labor movement, particularly in the East Coast, local unions were so galvanized by the struggle after 2.5 years. They were ready to engage in mass nonviolent civil disobedience in the tradition of the civil rights movement at the Purchase, New York, national headquarters of Pepsi-Cola. And they were going to put thousands and thousands and thousands of people there with mass arrests, if necessary, or there would be too many people the police could arrest them. And the leadership of the union, the paper workers, the Staley Workers Union, said, no, we can't do that. It's illegal. We might get sued. There might be a court injunction. We might have to pay a fine, and we must at all times obey the law. And, of course, the activists said, well, Dr. King didn't obey the law. When the law is unjust, we're not for violence, but we have to nonviolently resist. It's the only way we can win. If we follow the worst labor laws in the world, we'll lose every single time. So the demonstration got called off, and the movement just kind of came to an end. The workers felt like without leadership, there's no hope. So much of our book is about we need to revitalize the labor movement. Look at what happened to Republic Windows. You know, they didn't say, well, let's file a lawsuit. in December of last year. They said, we're going to occupy the building. They're not going to sell all this machinery and run off and build a new non-union plant in Iowa. We're going to occupy our Windows factory until they pay us what we're owed. They broke the law. It was trespassing. And the response was so much support across the country. I mean, demonstrations across the country, masses of people coming to the Chicago plant every day. And on 2 days' notice, 1,000 people surrounded the Bank of America building in the middle of the day. Most people were working. I mean, people are just looking for leadership of a workers' struggle that will say, come join us. We're going to fight for justice. Mm. They've had enough of the greed in this country. It's just gone, you know, crazy.
We've got some callers lined up, so let's go and talk with some listeners. Next, we're going to go to a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi there. I have two questions. One of them is I'm wondering if your guests would talk a little bit about labor and how they're dealing with minorities today, including women. And I'm also really curious about CJ having said that keeping the formation of the middle class or something like that, indicating that the unions were people in the unions were middle class, and I'm wondering how they're breaking down class. I would see them as working class, but anyway, I'll let them answer and I'll get off the line. Thanks.
Okay. Who wants to take the question?
Well, I think we can both answer it. The first part is, you know, the book is quite honest about the treatment of the African-American and women workers in the plant, women, white, and black, who began to be hired in the 70s. There was just tremendous racism and sexism, both from union leaders and from, of course, the company. And too many of the union activists didn't like what was going on, but they wouldn't speak out. So the black workers eventually became leading activists in the Staley struggle after the lockout. But it wasn't clear they were going to do that from the beginning because of how badly they'd been treated and how the union wouldn't fight for them. And the women as well, the sexism and sexual harassment in the plant. You know, I mean, we have laws now that the labor movement has fought for to protect people of color and women, but just put in lawsuit sexual harassment or racial harassment in your Google, and you'll come up with hundreds of hits. Unfortunately, it's still too widespread. But unions are one of the most, aside from maybe churches, one of the most prominent organizations in the country that bring together black and white and Hispanic. And they, when they're doing their job right, which is most of the time, they fight for civil rights for blacks and Latinos. And when there's racial harassment and sexual harassment against women, they fight to defend the contract, which always has language saying this is prohibited, this is illegal, we're going to fight for our workers. You know, and the biggest labor struggles we've seen in recent times, like at Republic Windows or the Justice for Janitors campaign, we had a huge strike of janitors in Houston a couple of years ago. CJ was very involved in the University of Miami janitor strike. Some of our biggest struggles have actually been Hispanic workers and black workers. So I really see them and women workers, very much women leaders. I see those segments along with, of course, white workers as being a huge part of the transformation of the labor movement that's happening now and that's going to continue. We're either going to become a truly multiracial labor movement led by women and blacks and Hispanics and not just led by white guys that are over 60, or else we'll die. I mean, it's quite that simple. Thanks. And the phrase about middle class, you know, everyone talks about middle class. You'll never hear politicians talking about the working class. We're one of the few industrialized countries where somehow we run away from the words worker and working class. So, you know, sometimes CJ and I use that language ourselves. Middle class means you're a well-paid with good benefits worker. That's all it means. But we're really talking about building a working class movement with allies in the community. That's what it's about.
Let's take another call. This listener is in Mattoon on line two. Hi.
This conversation is exactly what's wrong with this country. The workers, which take the paycheck and go home, have lost the fact that what's going on. What's wrong with this country is exactly what we're talking about. The unions think they run things. They think they're mistreated, and yet they still take their paycheck. And I've been to Staley before, and and worked around there some, and those people are the slowest working, most dilatory people I've ever seen. And if I owned the company, you know, I wouldn't put up with that. I don't know why that the unions put up with that too. They should not put up with that kind of slothful, dilatory, you know, lazy people, and they don't get it. They don't have a clue what's going on.
Well, I couldn't disagree more, respectfully, sir. Glenn Pichard, who was the congressman at the time, is someone that we interviewed with. He was extremely supportive of this workforce. And we have a quote in the book that I'd like to read, if that's okay, Celeste.
Sure.
Where Glenn Pichard talks about the significance of Urbana, Decatur, and Springfield, and how those three towns are aligned to really give us the substance of what the Midwest and Illinois is all about. And so all of these are his words. This is the way I saw Central Illinois. You've got Champaign with its great university, and that's sort of the head. You've got Springfield with its legislator and home of Abraham Lincoln, and that's sort of the heart and soul. And you've got Decatur right in the middle, and that's the brawn. That's the sinew, the muscle. That's what the workers took pride in. They felt like that was their contribution. You look around Decatur, that's a blue-collar community. Community in Decatur is factories. People take pride in that. Somebody has to build this country through sweat, and that's what the union makes people proud of. We have a contribution here to make. We're the builders of this nation.
Well, I agree with that, but I don't agree with the way unions are they just don't get it. They are unwilling to change. And they just
how do you want them to change?
Well, you can look around any of these towns. Once the unions get involved, they overdo it. They take everything to an extreme and end up they lose their jobs and they don't get it. They're losing their jobs and their houses and their families, and they don't get it. If they, you know, if they don't want to work, get somebody else in there to work. If they don't want to work.
Well, I have to tell you, American workers are among the most productive in the world. American productivity has gone up steadily year after year after year while wages have been stagnant for 25 years, adjusted for inflation. American workers work their tails off. And if you go to any blue-collar or any factory job, I mean, the sweat. I worked in one of those factories, and I worked my tail off, the sweat. You know, you've got to drink a gallon of water a day in the summer, or you become totally dehydrated. You're working your tail off. It's freezing in the winter. It's mind-numbing labor. And they don't get paid that much. The average median wage is, what, $19 an hour in America? A quarter of all household income in America, that's two or three people working off, and a quarter of the people in America, 25,000 or less, that's before taxes, and 40% of the country is 35,000 or less. You know, we've got like four out of 10 workers are in working poverty. They work, but they're poor, and they get food stamps, and they get Section 8 housing, and they get free school lunches for their kids, because the corporations demand so much money. They've got to have their 10 yachts and their 15 mansions for the CEOs and their bonuses of $100, $200 million a year. The workers work hard, and they want to turn out a good quality product. They just want fair treatment in return.
I want to thank the listener for his call, and we'll go on and take another call now. A listener on line 3 in Champaign County. Hi.
Hi. I think what's wrong is that last caller. I mean, if he worked there as a contractor and saw, you know, just dropped in and said he saw people, you know, feather bedding or whatever, you know, that's just one instance. You know, I think he's a big part of the problem. But I wanted, you know, that I don't know how much you did. I didn't come in at the very beginning. I regret. But the idea that people should, you know, work these shifts that they instituted there is just outrageous. I mean, they instituted shifts that are 3 days on, 3 days off, 12 hours. Did you line this out?
Yes.
Beginning? You did.
Not in this show, but in the book itself.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, but I mean, I think it's important for people to realize that you know, the old saw is that the unions gave us the work week. Well, Staley took it back. Basically, they don't that you don't, if you work at Staley, I don't know if it's still this way now, but that's what they, that's what the unions were rebelling against, was the idea that you could work 3 days on, 3 days off, 12-hour shifts. So you don't have a weekend anymore. It actually works out to more than 40 hours a week on the aggregate. So this is what people were fighting. And it's a good fight, and we need more of it, and I appreciate the effort that you've put into it. But I really have to take issue with that caller, because that is exactly what's the problem at this point, in my opinion. And so I know there's a very few minutes left, but I went to some of these rallies, and it's just heartbreaking. And you know, you did mention that the corporate campaign was bailed out on by the international, but the people at Staley basically felt that they were sold down the river by the international paper workers, and there was a transformation of who was actually doing the work. I think I better give up here at this point, and thank you for your efforts, and please keep up the work. Thanks.
Thanks for the call. Other calls are invited this afternoon. Our guests this afternoon, C.J. Hawking and Stephen Ashby, they are the authors of Staley, The Fight for a New American Labor Movement. It's a volume in the series, The Working Class in American History, from the University of Illinois Press. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us. We've got maybe 10 minutes left in this portion of the program. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. This is an interesting part of the story the last caller alluded to, the United Paper Workers International Union. It became the union there at Staley in Decatur. I forget the year, 1989 maybe, was it? I don't recall now. But anyway, within short order of the merger, the workers at Staley would begin to doubt the wisdom of it. Fill us in a little bit about what happened here.
Well, the lockout happened in June of 93, and within 6 months, the AIW, Allied Industrial Workers, had merged with the paper workers, January 1st, 1994. So at the first 6 months of the struggle of the post-lockout period, the workers had an international that was so small and had so few staff members, they were pretty much on their own. Now that sounds kind of isolating, but there was a benefit to that, that they didn't have anybody hovering over them telling them what they could or could not do. As a matter of fact, before the lockout, because the AIW was kind of on the downslide, these workers were able to bring in labor educators and to hire outside consultants. And that's really what invigorated them to figure out strategy and to fight back. So then in January 94, 6 months after the lockout happened, the paper workers take over. And it becomes clear pretty quickly that they are not pleased with this so-called dissident local that's stirring up all this trouble. They were located in Nashville, Tennessee, which is about 5 hours away from Decatur, but the international president of the United Paper Workers International Union never even came to Decatur until the workers showed up on the doorstep of the AFL-CIO Executive Council meeting in February of 95 to basically embarrass him and the other leaders for having never come to Decatur. Here they had rallies, as your callers are mentioning, thousands and thousands of people, but the leadership within the labor movement hadn't even come there, with the exception of one international president. So, again, the paper workers were not happy with this local union, and as time went on, it became more and more clear they really wanted to shut this fight down. You know, anybody who's locked out and living on $60 a week picket pay and lining up for the bags of food donations every week, it gets pretty tiring and you get pretty worn down. And sure enough, there was a faction within the Staley local union that wanted to fight the shut the fight down. It was mostly the workers who were a little bit older and simply wanted their severance packages and to get out, and had very little concern for those who were actually going to have to return to the plant, those who were in their 40s and 50s. So this faction within the local union found a lot of advice from Nashville and from the international union, and found a way in which to shut down the fight, which is another piece of what happened towards the end, especially as we were marching towards the Pepsi victory.
The International took the view, or the had a philosophy that you call business unionism. How common is that? What is business unionism, and how common is that in the labor movement today?
Well, of course, you know, as a historian, I can say from the 1870s to the 1940s, 70 or 80 years of struggle. When workers had no laws until the 30s protecting their right to organize, no Fair Labor Standard Act banning child labor or giving a minimum wage. And it was a very bottom-up movement, and there weren't any big buildings and huge staff or high salaries. It was not an institution. It was a social movement. And then once labor became established in the 40s and was basically said, we're here to stay, you're not going to get rid of us, it kind of evolved into an institution, and less of a, we call it the labor movement, but less of a movement. And many of the members became apathetic. We get better and better contracts every year. I support my union, but I don't really need to go to meetings. Let the leaders take care of my problems for me. And a new layer of leadership kind of rose up with that attitude. We don't need the members to be involved. We aren't a social movement. We're an institution, and I should get a high salary, and we got to protect our buildings and not engage in any civil disobedience or do anything where we might lose them. And that's what we call business unionism, kind of a top-down bureaucratic institutional view of unionism, as opposed to kind of a, what the Staley workers were, or the Effingham workers, or many others struggle, the Republic Windows workers, social movement unionism, kind of a bottom-up, members run the unions, reach out to allies in women's groups, civil rights groups, neighborhood groups, student college students. We have 200 college campuses where there are student groups fighting for workers' rights today. Very dynamic, very exciting. Mm-hmm. There's the national group Jobs with Justice that brings together labor and community people. So those are the kind of two counterposed visions. And really the Staley workers local used to be kind of business unionists, kind of apathetic and uninvolved, and they transformed themselves into this 1,000 people a week coming to meetings, sending scores of workers on the road, huge rallies, civil disobedience. They transformed themselves, and that's kind of the debate in labor today and why we wrote the book. We really see a need, if labor is going to survive, it needs to transform itself into what it used to be, a social movement again, reaching out to other social movements to fight for all workers everywhere, which was one of the slogans of the Staley workers.
Let's take one more call this afternoon. A listener in Clinton on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I want to thank the people that wrote the book. I don't disagree with anything I've heard them say today, because, no one person is always right, and the international unions were probably as much fault as some others, but I'm sure glad they wrote the book, and I hope at the end of the program you will repeat the name of the book and let people read it and understand, because during that period of time, I worked at Caterpillar. That wasn't a fun thing either for about 6 years. Mm-hmm. It was similar but different, but I definitely have sympathy and understanding for the Staley workers, and I'm glad that somebody is taking the time and effort to put it in print for posterity, and I thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. C.J. Stephen, you want to comment?
Well, the Caterpillar workers were phenomenally generous to the Staley workers. The Cat workers themselves had gone through quite a struggle with the company in 91, 92. So when these workers were locked out in 93, the Staley workers would stand outside of the plant gates on a Friday morning, and the Caterpillar workers, as they would drive into the plant, would throw into the buckets of the Staley workers $10, $20, and $50 bills. And most often, these plant gate collections resulted in about $50,000. Total, and I think one plant gate collection would be about $10,000. And so the CAT workers were just absolutely phenomenal. Larry Solomon was the president of their local at the time, and he and Dave Watts, the president of the Staley Workers local, became very close and really shared a lot. As for the book itself, I did also want to mention that we have a website about the book, and it includes a section, Where Are They Now?, so that you can read about what these workers did in the mid-90s and then go to the website and find out what it is they're doing now. And that website is www.staleybook.org.
Okay, and people can also read excerpts from the book.
Correct.
At the website, www.staleybook.net, correct?
.org.
I'm sorry. Okay. All right. And what I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to take a question that's come in. Somebody can't join us on the telephone this afternoon, and we're right out of time here. Someone raises the question about the future of workers in terms of automation replacing workers, and I don't have very much to go on here, but maybe the question might be, how does this impact the labor movement in the years to come?
Well, I'm all for automation. I'm all for anything that'll make workers' jobs easier. I'm all for anything that'll produce more product faster and easier without breaking the backs of workers. The question always throughout our history is, who gets the benefit of that? Does it mean more mansions and more CEO salaries and billions in profits for the corporations? Or does it mean the workers have a little easier job and they get a little higher pay? That's the struggle. That's why we need a labor movement, to defend workers and put workers' interests first.
And there we have to leave it. We're out of time. There's so much more here to this story. I hope that people will look for the book and pick it up. Our guests this afternoon have been Stephen Ashby and C.J. Hawking. They are the authors of Staley, The Fight for a New American Labor Movement. The book is one of the volumes in the series The Working Class in American History from the University of Illinois Press. And again, our guests, you'll find them online, more about the book, at www.staleybook.org.
And that was an interview from the AM 580 archives from July 1st of this year. It's 6 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices are in now. And with the numbers on the grains, here's AM 580's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Tom. The numbers finished up like this in Chicago this afternoon for a Monday. Nearby September wheat was higher for the day, as is the rest of the pit there. But corn futures were mixed. Nearby contracts September and December were higher. The others were a bit lower, and then beans moved sharply lower in several of the contracts. We'll get to those numbers in a moment. Back to the wheat, where 4 cents was the gain in the nearby September. A high price today at 473.5, a low at 453.25. Settled at $4.71, up 4 cents. December 502, the high, the low at 480.75. Soft red September, or rather December, settled at 498.75, up 3.5. And the March contract of 521.5 top, bottom at $5.50. Settled 518.25, up 3.5 cents. May futures, 532 the high, the low at 14.5. Settlement price at 531, up 3.25. In July of 2010, a 547 high, a low at 526.5. New crop wheat, 543.5, the settlement price up 3.25 in Chicago. September wheat in Kansas City, where the hard red is traded, up 5 cents at $5.05. Back in Chicago, corn pit now, $3.26 was the high for the day, and the lead option September, the low at 315. Settlement price, $3.26.25, up 5.25. December futures, 332 the high, the low at $3.20. Settled 329.75, up 3/4. The March contract at 345.25 high, low at $3.33.75. Settlement price at 342.5, down 0.25. May futures, 354.25 the high, the low at 43. Settlement price at 351.25, down 0.25. And July contract, 362.5 the high, the low at 51.25. Settlement price $3.59.25, down 0.75 cents. September oats 216 the high, the low at 208.75. Settled $2.10.75, unchanged for the day. Now the soy complex, nearby December futures, or rather September futures, down 35.75 today. $11.47 the high, the low at 10.94. Settlement price for the SEP beans at $11 even, down 35.75. November contract 10.18.75 the high, the low at 9.67.25. Settlement price at $9.79.5, down 31.5. And January futures, 10.18 the high. That's $10.18 for the January high. The low at 9.68.75. Settlement price, $9.81.25, down 30.5 cents. March futures, 10.14 the high. The low at 9.66.75. Settled at $9.79.25, down 28. In the May, at $9.72.5, down 26.75. Next year's November beans, 9.50 the high, the low at 17, settled at $9.26.5. November 2010 contract down 17.5 cents in the soybean pit. Now the bean meal futures, nearby September contract 393.50 the high, low at 372, settled 382.50, down $4.50. October contract $11.20, lower at $308.80 a ton. September soybean oil, 36.21 the high, the low at 34.75, settled at 34.99, down 108, and the October contract 35.19, down 108 as well. A couple things to keep in mind. I'll be back at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock with the closing mark report when we'll talk with Kurt Kimmel. And don't forget, tomorrow we'll be out at the Farm Progress Show all day, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, either at the AgriGold tent or in the University of Illinois tent. Please come by and see us. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
And now the closing livestock prices. A down day for cattle. Lean hogs were mixed today. The August live cattle contract had a high of 84.60, low of 81.65. Settlement price 82.67.5, down 197.5 as it went off the board today. October live cattle had a high of 86.70, the low 86 even, settled at 86.67.5, down 2.5. December live, the high 86.95, the low 86.42.5, settlement price 86.82.5, down 27.5 cents. And February had a high of 87.47.5, the low 87.02.5, settlement price 87.27.5, down 30. Onto the feeder cattle pit, the September contract had a high of 97.90, the low 97.20, settled at 97.25, that's down 90 on the day. October had a high of 97.75, the low 97.10, settlement at 97.42.5, down 62.5. November feeders, the high 98.40, the low 97.85, settled at 98.02.5, down 52.5. January of next year, the high 99.40, the low 98.90. Settlement price 99.27.5, down 20 on the day. Onto the October lean hog contract, the high 48.60, the low 47.32.5, settled at 48.15, up 7.5. December lean hogs at a high of 46.65, the low 45.75. Settlement price 46.22.5, down 22.5 cents. February had a high of 53.40, the low 52.35, settled at 53.35, up 57.5. April, the high 58.40, the low 57.37.5, settled at 58.22.5, down 2.5 cents a hundredweight. And pork bellies for the nearby month, the high 76.50, the low 74.55, settlement at 76.25, down 25 cents. And those are the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile.